This is CliffCentral.com.
Youth Leadership Platform.
Fear's a powerful thing. I mean, it's got a lot of firepower. If you can figure out a way to wrestle that fear, to push you from behind rather than stand in front of you, that's very powerful.
I have a dream.
Multiplying leadership, moving society. The millennial way.
You don't want to end up going after goals and dreams and neglect yourself.
Welcome to the Youth Leadership Platform with your host, Bongani Dao.
Take control. Take control of your city. This is the instrument of your liberation.
See, old friend, I brought more soldiers than you did.
Identify yourself to the world.
Welcome back to the Youth Leadership Platform with your host, Bongani Dao. Follow the conversation on at Simply Bongani across all social media. YIP Cliff Central on Twitter and Instagram. Youth Leadership Platform on Facebook. Like we promised, we are continuing the conversation today with our famous author, powerful woman, very incisive, author of Lost Where We Belong, Claire L. Bell. Welcome back to the Youth Leadership Platform, Claire.
Hi, Bongani. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you so much. So last week we left it off at, I think it was chapter 6, where we were speaking about faith. And, you know, some of the memories that you have visiting the hometown of Walter Sisulu. One interesting question that I'd like to ask, I guess, to begin the second leg of the question. You speak a bit about faith, as in faith in terms of religion, and some of the questions that you had. So I'd like us to explore the religious side of Claire L. Bell.
Well, I grew up in Benoni, and it was very popular at the time to go to the youth church on a Sunday night. But I think it was more to see the boys and to go up in your than anything else. And I actually, in latter years, I've actually had quite a lot of anger towards the church, because I feel like, you know, we used to have discussions about things like what is justice, what is fairness, what is love, and we were living in a society that was anything but just, anything
oh,
but
yes.
fair,
oh, yes.
anything but full of love. So I have a very complex relationship with the church itself. And in fact, in the book, in Lost Where We Belong, I go back and see my minister at the Methodist Church in Benoni and actually hold him to account in some ways and ask him why we weren't talking about these things, why this wasn't on the table at the time. So in terms of my own spirituality in this day and age, I think I'm one of those people which some people will roll their eyes at, but I'm more spiritual than a kind of Christian per se. You know, I see there's so much coincidence, serendipity, so much beauty that happens in the world. You have faith in something, someone comes along and helps you just when you need it. So I completely believe that there's something bigger than all of us. But I have a lot of discomfort with them attributing it to certain institutions, because I've seen so much injustice delivered from those institutions.
Interesting. So do you believe in God, though?
I do believe in God.
Okay.
But I have a problem. I have a problem with all the prophets like Jesus and Muhammad and all of those, because I feel often there have been, it seems to me often there have been, oh, you better not put this on, actually, because if I say something about Muhammad, I'll be around my head. Please cut that. I have a bit of an issue with how I have a problem with how the texts of the religious texts have often been used to oppress women, oppress societies, and justify, unfair practices and
like
power
slavery.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So I have a huge problem with that. And I think it's not God's fault, it's our fault.
So looking at history, did you get a bit of a cognitive dissonance when it came to some of the religious ideals that you once espoused?
I'm not sure I espoused them that much. Like I said, I think I was more interested in seeing the boys. But, you know, I've always been I studied philosophy.
Okay.
At university, and I've always been a thinker and enjoyed contemplating things like what is morality, you know, what is justice, what is fairness. I don't feel that the church is the only way to contemplate those things. I have experienced, you know, I have in my sort of 30s, I have been on quite a few Buddhist meditation retreats.
Okay.
And with Buddhism, which doesn't worship a god per se, you know, Buddha was a person who was basically using meditation and practice and breath and introspection to question life, to question what it is to live a good life, what it is to suffer, what it is to be attached, what it is to not be attached to our lives and to our hopes and dreams. I find that Buddhism offers a lot of help, like practical help, assistance in navigating and contemplating life. Where often Christianity, to me, can give you sort of, you know, the aim, or they can give you the sort of where you'd like to be, but doesn't seem to give you a lot of help along the way for me. So I found a lot of support from Buddhism because I love contemplating life, our existence, who we are, and trying to be a better person myself. And I think that, any tools that we can find along the way from the spiritual world, from the analytical world, we should gather them up in our arms.
Before we get into the book, I'm quite fascinated because I also enjoy philosophy. Well, how would you define morality?
Well, define a morality?
Yes.
It's to be moral, to live a good life.
Okay. Yes.
It doesn't harm others. That perhaps doesn't harm yourself. That is a benefit. To who is of benefit? I guess it's to benefit of all humans, but also to animals, to our earth, to our plants, to our healthy life that will benefit and in which we can all be nurtured and grow.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there are many needs that human beings have. The need to eat, the need to survive, the need to have vices. Sometimes you need to kind of let off steam. That's also very human. It's not, you know, can't be just pure all the time. So I guess it's how do we find the best ways to live the whole human experience with as little harm as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps that.
Chapter 10. Amongst a lot of things that happen, you sort of ask questions that reflect to me that being as a woman in, you're trying to figure out as well, or at least at this point, your place in this transformed South Africa. So not so much as a white person, but now as a woman. What are some lessons that you can, you know, impart about some of the things, observations really, that you can make about that experience?
About being a woman in post-apartheid South Africa.
Sure. Have you found your place?
Have I found my place as a woman in post-apartheid South Africa? It's a difficult one for me because I know I'm a woman. I'm having a baby. But I don't think of myself as a woman. I don't think of myself as a woman first. I think of myself as a person first, and I always have. And I've never thought I couldn't do something because I'm a woman. It's never crossed my mind.
Mm.
I didn't grow up in that household. My father didn't ever say I couldn't do something because I was a woman. He would say I couldn't do something because we didn't have the money for it.
Interesting.
Or maybe someone from our class wouldn't do that thing because I grew up as from a working class Yorkshire family living in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So... But the idea that I was a woman didn't really cross my mind. So yeah, as a woman in post-apartheid South Africa, I don't carry a lot of the oppression in me, in my body, in my physical body.
Okay.
Against, you know, the patriarchy, like I don't hold it in me with anger and frustration because I haven't experienced it, but I can completely see how others have. So, but you're asking me what's my place as a woman. I get, you know what, maybe it is. I know with Consciousness Cafe, with KK and I, when we lead or facilitate conversations, as women, I think we have a nurturing ability. We have this ability to bring people together, to make them laugh, to make them feel warm and welcome, and to really encourage them to excavate their emotions. I'm not saying a man can't do this, but it seems that people respond very well to Consciousness Cafe because it is run by two women. So I wonder if there's something in that, that there's a sort of the, whereas men, you know, are often, you know, men are defending the cave and, you know, kind of going out hunting and, you know, the old fashioned kind of rhetoric.
Yes.
But there's something about women that women were always, you know, they're always trying to find commonalities with each other. They'll try and have a conversation. They'll try and kind of bring people together more. They do have that more. Whereas my husband will always say, you know, men don't do that. We kind of check each other out. We're a bit wary of each other first. So maybe, you know, because we have this wariness in South African culture, this sort of hangover, this legacy of apartheid, where there's kind of wariness, holding back from each other, everyone's checking each other out still. Maybe as women, and my role as women as Consciousness Cafe is actually to break through that and to try to bring people together to have these kind of conversations. So I feel very, I do feel very empowered and very in the right place when I'm standing with Keke in a room of like 20 people of all races and genders and actually getting them to really talk to each other. You know, I feel that that's a really good use of my skills, is whether they're women's skills or just person skills, I'm not sure.
Between word, books.
Yes. I was going to say there are men who host consciousness cafes,
sure,
and really trained facilitators and very skilled, and they do an amazing job. But one of them did say to me, I do think the fact that you as two women lead this organization has made people sort of lean towards it in a way that they might not wasn't men, if it was men.
Books, libraries, and education in the new South Africa. You know, our pass rate is, what, 30% for mathematics?
Uh-huh.
If you go to township schools, there's hardly textbooks to study with, let alone libraries with actually books that are up to date, that are current, that are modern, that, you know, carry ideas and theories that are updated.
Well, when I was in the Eastern Cape, I think that was when the old Transkei, that was one of the things that, you know, shocked me. It's not that the schools don't have libraries. It, you know, the one school in Mboiki village didn't have enough classrooms. So one of the classrooms was missing. So on the day that it rained, the grade ones would not come to school so the matrix could have their class.
Oh, my word.
But when it wasn't raining, the matrix had the class outside under the tree in South Africa. And people were sitting in desks that were too small for their age. So that made me very, very angry again. And then through the book, I came across an organization in Cape Town called The Bookery, which has been building libraries in South Africa. So 92% of schools in South Africa do not have a school library. Sheesh. And it was considered by the Department of Education to be, you know, unrealistic for that to be amended because the legacy is just too great, which The Bookery took, and Equal Education took a real offense with that. And they said, that's absolutely ridiculous. Let us prove to you that we can do this. And over the past, I think it's now 7 years, they've built 53 libraries in schools in the Western Cape and some in Johannesburg as well. So, these books are donated by people from all over the country and actually across the world. And they're up to date. They only put the best quality books in with the interesting ideas and shiny covers. There's no point giving a child a old thumbed book to read. They're not going to pick it up. You know, a poor child is going to just want a sexy new book, just like a rich child will. So they really come from that premise, and they've had a huge impact. They've been training also parents to be librarians and starting reading clubs at the school and getting, you know, people from the community to come in and sit with the children and help them to read. Because, of course, reading, you know, when you start reading, that's the hardest part, you know, when you first try to kind of pin down those words. And they've really had an impact on the outcomes at those schools. So, yeah, I mean, for me, I feel that getting libraries into schools is critical, especially in communities where it's unsafe to perhaps walk to the public library
mm-hmm.
or catch a bus to the public library.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then, yes, it'd be great if we can all go to the public libraries and we don't need, you know, then the schools could all just share one library. Mm. But it's not always possible. So, yeah, I think that without reading, without a culture of reading, we don't learn to interrogate people's opinions other than our own. We don't get to really hear people's opinions other than our own
mm.
or our family. You know, you can hear them on the radio, you can hear them on social media, but actually when you sit with a book, you sit with somebody else for hour upon hour upon hour, and it's like a really deep conversation you have. And I think that's how our minds shift, when we actually sit close together, be it in person or through words of a book. So, yeah, I'd like to see a lot more reading in South Africa. I mean, that's also just to say another thing that makes me so angry in South Africa is that, but books are taxed.
Sure.
Books are taxed. They're not taxed in other countries. They're not taxed in the UK. So when I came to, you know, South Africa, a book costs, a domestic worker may earn 200 to 300 rand a day. That's the price of a book.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
In the UK, a book costs £7 and the minimum wage is like £5.60. So you work 1 hour on minimum wage to buy 1.5 hours to buy a book. And in South Africa, you have to earn work the whole day to buy
wow.
a book.
Wow.
That puts it in perspective.
Hmm.
That's why we don't have a culture of literacy that we, and which we really need.
Yeah.
And I, for me, how we can bring the prices of books down, they remain this middle class item, so that only the sort of the middle classes, the wealthy, can buy them. But that just keeps everybody out forever. So,
and it doesn't help, because some of the people's characters that need to be influenced by these books then do not get access to that education. And then we end up in a society where there's people that still want to act or behave in a barbaric manner. But if it was freely accessible, the same with education, to a lot of people, then we'd have a better society, because we'd have a society of thinkers.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Coming back to Benoni, you know, I guess it's Benoni from the Hebrew word that means son of my suffering, which is, I guess, the opposite of Benjamin, who is son of my plenty. What are some of the lessons that you learned in your hometown?
I just want to just correct the national minimum wage in the UK, because it has gone up.
Oh, okay.
So it's actually for 25 and over now, it's £7.83 for an hour. And actually £5.90 is the 18 to 20 year old amount.
Interesting.
So, yeah, and just to clear that up. So what was the question? What are the lessons from Benoni?
Yes.
Get out. Keep running. No, sorry. From growing up there?
Yes.
From when I went
well, well when you went back, and I mean you confronted your principal at Benoni High, you went to the Methodist, you know, the preacher, the person in charge there, going to the public library as well, and reading across some of the books and seeing the prejudices carried in the literature, how they've, you know, captured history in a manner that shines a bad light on black people, which is just perpetuating that form of racism. But all, you know, the collective lessons that you learned from going to these different places and now seeing Benoni from a different perspective years later.
I guess I think returning to Benoni to go to meet my school teachers and to go to the libraries at school and at in town, and to visit friends from that who still live there. I think I saw very clearly, and I think I probably already had seen it, but it was just probably reaffirming it, how cloistered that society was, you know, how deeply shut down it was. And it was set up to, I don't know, just it's a place that's set up where you can kind of be safe, but not be challenged in any way. There's nothing there which really, I think there's nothing there which challenges the mind or provokes the mind or, I feel there's nothing there aspirational for the mind anyway. And when I met one of my teachers, she said, you know, we were the teachers that had come out of JSC, Johannesburg School of Education.
Okay.
And she said, you know, we were a bunch of racists, you know, good little racists. She said, we were taught the party line and we towed the party line. And she said the teachers who had come from Wits, they were much more free thinkers, much more radical, you know. Mm. They questioned what was going on, but we didn't. And I think she was very honest about how, she was a product of a society. But what she also said, which was quite interesting, she said, I don't think we saw ourselves as racist. She said, because racism is to hate someone of another culture.
Mm.
But we didn't hate anybody. We just didn't think about them. They didn't even cross our minds.
You know,
and I thought that was very powerful.
And even I think the part where you reflect on how what they were teaching in school, you know, during military drills, history classes, for instance, how yes. take us through that instead of me butchering it for you.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because she's saying, I don't think we thought about black people. I don't think we thought about this other side of things. We just lived our own lives. But of course, we might not have actively thought, but it permeated all of life, because in another way, every week from when I was in standard 9, which is what, grade 11 now, we had to learn to march. So the boys had been marching since they were in standard 6, and they used to wear khaki to school on I think it was a Friday, and they had to go to these classes and learn to march. And the girls, of course, didn't have to march initially. We had to just go do some kind of craft or, you know, something girly, I don't know. But come standard 9, it was getting very near the end of apartheid. It was state of emergency. And no one explained why, but we had to start marching once a week, the girls. And at first we were absolutely appalled because we were like, oh, it's dirty and disgusting and sweaty and no thanks. And then we found out that the hot matric guys were going to be leading our squadron. So we quickly got over it and we're
the boys again.
absolutely delighted to be marching around the field following Sissy Anthony. So I think that's also, that shows really beautifully the sort of how the politics and the personal, you know, they brush alongside each other. And often we just totally ignore the politics because we're so immersed in our own little personal bubbles and our bubbles of our teenage years, our hormones, our families, our friends. It shows how often we lose sight of the bigger picture because we're caught in our little perspective.
Mm.
So, but actually in the book, I went back to meet the teacher who was in charge, he was a history teacher and he oversaw some of the marching, but he explained how he was so reluctant to do that and how it was against all of his ethos, and he had really struggled with the headmaster at the time about that. Mm. It was quite interesting to get into his, because he was one of the Wits teachers, the thinking teachers.
Mm.
And how he felt like, you know, you were a teacher and your job was to teach and to impart knowledge, and now you are being taught to sort of almost impart fear and to sort of in this kind of military order, and how he felt it was such a tension in him. But of course he's got a career, he's got a family, he lives in, so again it's that personal and political rubbing up against each other, and how do we make those choices in such a difficult society.
You make an observation now. I'm just fast tracking, looking at the time. Sure. Again, Mandela and Tutu. You say most people love Mandela and Tutu because they speak reconciliation, but reconciliation that does not mess with their comfort zone. What do you mean by that?
Do I say that in the book?
Was it you or was it Melissa Tando? I think
it's Melissa Tando that
okay.
says that.
Okay.
It's not me, but that's what she says.
But
yeah,
would you concur with that? Like an observation of white counterparts, I suppose.
You know, my husband was a foreign correspondent. He covered the end of apartheid. And he was, you know, in the townships covering the third force activities and the violence at the time. And I think that, you know, at the time, South Africa, at the time of the transition, South Africa was at a boiling point. And I think people often forget that. They forget what was happening. There was so, it could have gone horribly wrong and we could have ended up at civil war. And we didn't. And so maybe Mandela did have to make more, allowances than keep the status quo more than perhaps he wanted to, or perhaps people would have wanted him to. Mm-hmm. But I believe that he was overlooking a transition period. But that transition period is now over. And we are now at a new stage where we have to do something else. That does not mean that what Mandela did at the time was wrong. It just meant that it was what's necessary at the time. And now something else is necessary. And instead of harping back to the past, what was done wrong then, I think we should just focus on what needs to be done now. That's my opinion on that. Because I know that, you know, white people were frightened at the time. They were people, you know, there was people saying, we're going to come and take your house. There were people stockpiling food. There were people leaving. There was third force activity. There was hectic violence in the townships. You know, that was real, you know, that really happened. So we managed to transition to a peaceful country. And so now we do need to do something different. Absolutely. But different points of history require different decisions.
I think
to acknowledge that rather than to be angry that something wasn't done 20 years ago, which actually might not have been the time for it. Mm. Now is the time. So let's do it now.
Mm. It's interesting you say that, because I was in a conversation with the MD and partner at Goldman Sachs, Colin Coleman, who runs it in South Africa. And, you know, in the conversation, it came up that the general for South Africa during that transition, or right before that decision was made, that, you know, the general of the army here was in contact with America, and they were telling America to move on the situation because things were about to turn upside down. And he said, give us 48 hours. I said, we don't have 48 hours. And eventually he responded, I guess, the following day. But during that conversation, when Mandela signed off on a peace agreement, I guess it saved South Africa from seeing what could have happened, especially with calls like those that were made. Anyway, fast forwarding to, you know, somewhat the last pages of the book, you and Melissa Thando have a very striking and very liberating conversation to an extent, and a very complex conversation as well. So my question to you is, how do we make white South Africans uncomfortable so that we can then inspire, or, you know, start that snowball that will roll over to us having more complex conversations and starting actually fixing our issues?
How can we make white South Africans more uncomfortable?
Sure.
They already are. I think they're very uncomfortable at the moment.
Okay.
They're very uncomfortable. And I think personally, I think that we need to have conversations, but we need to do them with compassion. Okay. And I think that a lot of the conversations can be very finger pointing.
Okay.
And they can be very, I got no time for white people's feelings. I'm sick of pandering to them. I'm sick of explaining things to them. I'm just sick of them. I've had enough of them. They must sort their shit out. They mustn't come asking me what to do. That mentality.
Sure.
I think it's a shame, because we've come from like this entire like 23 years of silence, or 22 years of silence, to a very quick like 18 months of, right, like, let's wake up, let's become woke, let's see what's happening, let's call ourselves on this. And then I'm not talking to you about it now, though, because you've had long enough. And you're like, well, really? Have we had long enough? Because we've only really just started actually getting honest here. This is honesty is new to the table. And if you're going to start shouting at people, or kind of getting very angry very quickly, I'm not saying that anger is not justified. I'm not saying that at all. I think
sure,
it is.
Sure.
But we need, well, maybe we just need facilitators like myself or others to actually hold spaces where that anger is totally allowed, totally permitted. I'm not saying it should be shut down.
Sure, sure.
But we need to come together so it's in a kind of safe space for the anger to come out. Because if it's one-on-one, one person shouting at one person, you know, a radio presenter shouting at people, pointing fingers, all that's going to happen are people are going to retreat into boxes and retreat behind walls. So I feel collective spaces where we can get uncomfortable together are absolutely critical. But they, and then to have what happens in those spaces, you see a lot of compassion come up. You just do. South Africans quite like each other. They also like a good laugh.
True.
So you'll see a lot of humor will come into those spaces, a lot of mutual feeling and actually resonance with each other's stories. So, yeah. I think we just need to have a lot more compassion and a lot more, and realize that this is a long process. We're talking how many years of colonialism? 400? 500?
It's a lot.
You know?
Yeah.
What, we're going to start in 18 months? You know, after 20 years of silence in 18 months, oh, we're going to fix it.
No.
We're not. We have to slow down, have patience, listen to each other. And I totally understand how some people aren't interested and don't want to listen because they just want to get on with their own lives. And they're already tired. I understand that too. So I also say to people, someone asked me this actually at the book launch in Mabonnet. She said, how do you manage to sort of investigate yourself and interrogate yourself?
Mm-hmm.
And do you do it all the time? And I said, no, you can't. No, you cannot. Sometimes you have to just take a step back from this stuff for a few months and not be involved. And then when you're ready, step forward and be part of it again. You know, realizing that the personal and political are always going to live side by side.
True.
And going to brush against each other. And sometimes you have all the strength you need and time you want for the political. And sometimes your personal is so overwhelming. You're having a baby, your husband's got cancer, you've lost your job, whatever it is. And then you can't and you have to retreat. But it's the compassion to realize that we're all living these double lives all the time.
Mm.
And to see that we can't always participate.
Hmm.
But when we can, and when you have the energy, yeah, then give it a go. You know, go to one consciousness cafe or, you know, reach out one olive branch. And I think it's probably a lot more people doing that than we actually realize. But of course, that never gets the headlines, does it?
Never. One thing that you want people to take out of this conversation and the book. It's a difficult question to ask for one, but...
No, that's a question I can probably answer. But holding yourself to account, Socrates said, you know, the unexamined life is not worth living.
True.
And I really feel to live a whole life in South Africa and a full and sort of rich life, that we all need to look into our hearts and our minds a little bit more and introspect and sort of take ourselves on a personal journey of transformation.
Hmm.
And that no one can do it for you. And it's hard and you'll fail and you'll get hurt along the way. But actually, it's so worth it because my life has changed so much from writing this book. And I just feel like I live in all of South Africa now. I can walk anywhere and be part of any community.
Mm.
Not 100% part, but I can know that, yes, you are my fellow South Africans and we all live under the sky and we all struggle with this legacy in different ways. But this is our collective struggle. I feel that now. That feels a lot better than just living behind a high fence, with a panic button in your hand.
Wow. Thank you so much for joining us on the Youth Leadership Platform. It has been really a pleasure for me to have you on the show. And I hope that our listeners that are listening will feel the same or will share the sentiments and that this self-introspective conversation about, you know, the politics of South Africa and people living within that political context will go in deep and will help people to start moving in the direction of changing things. Any parting words?
Well, I just wanted to tell people where they could buy the book.
Okay.
So Lost Where We Belong. It's in stock at 7 exclusive bookstores in Stellenbosch, Somerset West, Mall of the South in Johannesburg, Durban Airport. Oh, I can't remember the other ones. Table Bay Mall. And it's also Love Books in Melville, Bridge Books in Maboneng in Joburg, mm-hmm. all of the Wordsworth bookstores in Cape Town, and also at the Book Lounge in Rodan Street in Cape Town. So, and also if you want to buy it online, you can buy it from Amazon, which and then they ship to you.
Oh, okay. So, your social media handles?
It's at WriterCLB.
At WriterCLB.
CLB, that's my Twitter handle, yeah. And also I write a blog called unpopularessays.com where I write about all sorts of stuff, including this. And there's an extract from the book, actually, up there at the moment that people can read as a for a taster.
Awesome. You're working on a book. I have it, I gather.
No, I'm not. I'm working on a baby, Bongani. The next book has to wait.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll talk about that a little bit later. Right now, it's still at the working phase. You don't talk about books at that phase.
Does the cancer story have a happy ending?
The cancer story?
Yeah, cancer.
The cancer story.
Yes.
Sorry, cancer. I was thinking Dorothy. Yes, my husband had two kinds of cancer, but he is. He's doing very well at the moment. Thank you very much for asking. And he's looking forward to becoming a daddy. So exciting.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your transparency. And like I said, you know, for such an important conversation on the youth leadership platform. And I think you are a leader in your rights, especially in driving conversations like this and really enforcing and upholding the principles of what it will mean for us to move to being a rainbow nation, because it starts with such self-introspective conversations, and that's where we will draw, I guess, the necessary courage, strength, and understanding that we need to move forward.
I said, thank you, Bongani. I'll keep those words very dear to my heart. Thank you so much.
Awesome. I'm looking forward actually to meeting up sometime in September.
Absolutely. Awesome. With a baby. I hope you're good with babies.
Yes, yes. All right, awesome. For our listeners, this has been another exciting episode of the Youth Leadership Platform. YLP Cliff Central, Twitter and Instagram. Youth Leadership Platform on Facebook at Simply Bongani across all social media platforms. Tell us what you want to hear more. Guests that you want us to have on the show. What's working, what's not working. Share this with your friends and family. And until the next episode, good day and God bless.
This is CliffCentral.com.